is The Current.
Good morning and welcome to The Current. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. It was back in the 70s that a Pakistani scientist by the name of A.Q. Khan spirited some crucial secrets for making nuclear bombs out of Europe. He helped his own country build the bomb, and then he set up a little business, selling what was considered taboo technology to a variety of countries, from Libya to Iran. We know that now. What we don't know is what his business arrangements might have been with those fighters who have no country, with terrorists. Organizations, in other words. This morning, we'll hear the concerns. Also this morning, it's no secret that women in abusive relationships often hide their torment because of fear, shame even, because they don't know where to turn for help. So consider the plight of women who are new to Canada, who speak neither official language, and who are desperate to escape an abusive relationship. This morning, in our third half hour, we'll hear the stories of women caught in such a trap, and we'll hear from those who are trying to reach them and help them. And they are both known for the dramas they can create, but when Michel Tremblay and Robert Lepage spoke up about their own misgivings on Quebec sovereignty, the reaction forced them onto center stage. This morning we're asking what the debate says about sovereignty's future. But The Current begins with a little real-life fear factor.
We have to be right 100% of the time. They only have to be right once. And when you're talking about terrorism with a nuclear weapon or terrorism with a nuclear device of some kind, you don't want to be wrong that one time.
Well, that was U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice speaking in a documentary that will air on CBC television this Thursday. It looks at the connection between the world's largest nuclear proliferation ring, known as the AQ Khan Network, and the threat of nuclear terrorism.
A.Q. Khan, a rogue Pakistani scientist, has done more than any other person or country to spread nuclear weapons around the world. This is the story of how he managed to get away with it for so long, and how the nuclear seeds he helped plant could explode anytime, anywhere.
Well, that is from the start of the documentary, Nuclear Jihad, Can Terrorists Get the Bomb? And Julian Scher is the writer, producer, and director of that documentary, and he's here to tell us more. He's in our Montreal studio. Good morning, Julian.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you again, Anna Maria.
Nice to have you with us. You know, those two words separately, nuclear and terrorism, can be frightening enough. Together, it's hard to think of anything scarier than nuclear terrorism.
That's true. And what's even scarier is that it's not just the hawks in the Bush administration who are raising these alarms. I mean, without exception, every top expert around the world that we talked to said that, one, terrorists can indeed get their hand on fissile material, that once they do that, it's not that hard to make a small bomb, and it's not difficult to smuggle it into Canada, the United States, or anywhere else. Matthew Bunn is one of the leading experts on nuclear proliferation that I spoke to. He's the director of the Managing the Atom Project at the Belfour Center in Harvard University. And when I sat down with him in Cambridge, here's how he ran through his danger checklist.
Is it plausible that a well-organized group could make a nuclear bomb if it got hold of the nuclear material? Yes, unfortunately, that's plausible. Is it plausible that they could get nuclear material? Unfortunately, the answer to that is also yes, it is plausible. Around the world, there are hundreds of tons of highly enriched uranium and separated plutonium, enough for tens of thousands of nuclear bombs.
Well, Julian, nuclear weapons have been with us for more than 60 years. Terrorism, too, unfortunately, is nothing new. So what has changed?
Well, to understand why all of this is possible today, you really have to understand how the rules of the nuclear chessboard, if you want, have been drastically transformed. And that's mainly because of privatization, the black market nuclear network that was set up by Abdul Qadir Khan, that scientist and a nuclear salesman from Pakistan.
Well, on North Korea, I think we need to start preparing our...
That noise and bustle that you hear, Anna Maria, is a board meeting at the IAEA. I was there. It's the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. It's the UN's watchdog for nuclear proliferation. I mean, these are the people who are supposed to be watching our safety. I spent a lot of time at their labs and at their satellite imagery rooms, and we spoke to their investigators. And we also spoke to their director, Mohammed El-Baradei, won the Nobel Peace Prize last year for his work. But he told me that A.Q. Khan and what Khan was doing shocked him when the revelations came to light in 2003.
That was an absolute wake-up call for everybody. When we first came to know about the A.Q. Khan, network, it was, to me, mind-boggling. I never, in my wildest dreams, imagined that you can have a Walmart, a fully operational network trading nuclear material, nuclear equipment.
Julian, so Mohammed El-Baradei, the director general of the IAEA, calls this a Walmart, the Khan network. Was A.Q. Khan's network that vast and that profitable?
It was. I'm not sure Walmart will be very proud with that name, but it was. It all started back in the 1970s. Here was a brilliant scientist. He's working in Europe, and he steals the secrets for the nuclear bomb, specifically how to build these very complicated centrifuges that spin fast enough to enrich uranium, which is needed to make fuel for the bomb. Pakistan, of course, back then and still now, was in a nuclear arms race with its hated rival, India. Now, Khan succeeds in blowing up a nuclear bomb in 1998, and he's celebrated as a national hero in Pakistan. Now, Khan's bomb, of course, was also dubbed the Islamic bomb, because this was the first nuclear weapon that was controlled by a Muslim country. The problem, though, Anna Marie, is that Khan didn't stop at giving the secret of his Islamic bomb to one Muslim country. He pulled off what's been called the greatest nuclear proliferation scheme in history. I mean, his global supply chain included a factory in South Africa. There was a centrifuge parts plant in Malaysia, electronics from Turkey, and even a bomb design from China.
And so who were his clients?
Well, pretty much anyone who had the money and the interest. One of the first people he approached, believe it or not, was Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein actually spurned Khan's offer because he thought this was all a Western plot.
So he thought it was like a setup.
That's right. Mm. That's right. And he actually could have had the weapons of mass destruction that he was...
That we thought he had.
That's right. Mm. North Korea, though, went for it big time. The North Koreans made a secret deal with Khan for his uranium centrifuge system. And for that, that was important because this system was much smaller and easier to hide than the sprawling facility that they already had. Libya went in big time. For $100 million, Khan helped build a nuclear weapon facility in Libya. Now, of course, by 2003, American and British intelligence services, it was really quite James Bond-like, managed to infiltrate deep inside the Khan network. They uncovered the Libya deal, and it exposed, really, for the first time to the world, the vast nature of this network. But unfortunately, most of the damage had been done, and most notably in Iran. Iran, of course, as you know, is really considered right now, today, and especially in recent events this week, the gravest threat to nuclear security. Well, we found out that Iran's nuclear program really wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the A.Q. Khan network. Back in the 80s, Iran secretly began buying these drawings and plans from Khan. Now, of course, we learned last week that Iran's president has proudly proclaimed that his country has joined the Club of Nuclear Countries. Iran, of course, insists that its intentions are nothing but peaceful. But, skeptics point out that they got all of their technology from Khan, who wasn't exactly in the business of selling electricity. I mean, he was selling nuclear weapons plans. And there's now reports that Washington could be seriously considering a possible preemptive military strike against Iran. So this whole mess is rapidly heating up. And in many ways, to sum up, this is really the first major way that the Khan network gave a boost to nuclear terrorism, by spreading nuclear weapons and fissile material and plans and technology around the world, often to very unstable and radical regimes.
Well, I think the global black market network that A.Q. Khan put together is almost without a doubt the greatest proliferation disaster of the nuclear age. Short of giving the bomb directly to Osama bin Laden, it's hard to think what would be worse than what A.Q. Khan and his network did.
That was Matthew Bunn, the director of Managing the Atom Project at the Belfer Center in Harvard University.
Now, Julian, you said the Libyan affair eventually exposed A.Q. Khan's activities. Now, we know he was put under house arrest in Pakistan, and at the time, President Bush hailed A.Q. Khan's demise as a rare victory in his war against terrorism. We've actually got that tape of President Bush right here.
The A.Q. Khan network has been brought to justice. The United States has exposed and disrupted a major black market operation in nuclear technology led by AQ Khan.
But now, Julian, President Bush makes it sound as if it's over. And your documentary disputes whether the Khan network has really actually even been fully exposed and disrupted.
Precisely. And it raises really the second big worry that we try to look at, which is that the privatized nuclear market and terrorism, the connection together is stronger because we just don't know what Khan was up to. I mean, for starters, there's been no access to Khan. Pakistan has barred the Americans or any other outsiders from having any contact with him.
Now, why? Well, what's that about?
Well, many people think that they're worried that Khan could spill the beans. Pakistan has always argued that he did all of this alone, and skeptics, including former leaders in Pakistan, will say, well, wait a minute, he wasn't building the nuclear bomb for himself. He was building it for the Pakistani military, which runs Pakistan. And keeping Khan shielded, in fact, leaves unanswered some of the big mysteries of what could have gone on behind the scenes at his laboratories. For example, we know that a top Saudi defense minister met with Khan, and Saudi Arabia really could just be one of many unknown potential nuclear clients. There were reports of interest in what Khan was doing from Malaysia, Egypt, Syria. Khan, of course, he is out of business. Yes, he's living a rather comfortable life of forced retirement in his home, but remnants of his black market could still be operating.
So should we be worried about Malaysia and Egypt and Syria and Saudi Arabia?
We should, and investigations are going on around the world. But the biggest fear that experts have is not just governments, but individual buyers, and of course, including terrorists. Now, what you're hearing right now is the quiet operations inside a room at the Vienna headquarters of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency. They are actually poring over computers that were turned over by Libya, as you remember, Khan's last known client.
Mm.
Now, they discovered that the Khan network had made digital copies of the nuclear centrifuge plans, and they have no idea how many copies were made or who got them. Here's how the IAEA's Director General, Mohammed El-Baradei, put it.
The network not simply worries me because of their supply to government, but the network worries me a much greater deal because of possible supply to terrorists. We are in a race against time because we know that Al-Qaeda and other extremist groups would love to have to get their hands on nuclear weapons.
Now, that was Mohammed El-Baradei, the director general of the IAEA. And around the world, nuclear experts really share his fears, Anna Maria. I mean, there's no evidence, you know, don't panic in your chairs right now. There's no evidence that Osama bin Laden or like-minded fanatics actually have yet obtained fissile material, much less a weapon. But Osama has never hidden his intent. David Albright is a former weapons inspector. I visited him at his office in Washington. He heads the Institute for Science and Security. He showed me a document aptly called the Superbomb. It was left behind by Al-Qaeda when the Taliban fell in Afghanistan.
It was an attempt to try to lay out how do you go about understanding and building a nuclear weapon. We saw this document as establishing that Al-Qaeda wanted nuclear weapons. And unfortunately, no one has ever failed building one.
That was David Albright of the Institute for Science and Security in Washington.
Well, what's he saying, though, that once you have the enriched uranium, that actually building the bomb is pretty straightforward and fail-proof?
The frightening truth is that's right. I mean, getting your hands on the fissile material is the tough part. After that, it's relatively easy. One person said to me, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist, especially if you're trying to build what's called a simple gun implosion device, similar to what was used in Hiroshima, where you take two pieces of uranium and essentially smash them together. Now, we know that in Taliban-ruled Afghanistan in the late 1990s, Al-Qaeda made a number of attempts to get their hands on this kind of fissile material, especially for sale on the black market after the Soviet Union collapsed. And we know that Osama bin Laden himself personally met with a top Pakistani nuclear scientist. It was Kabul in August of 2001, and he questioned him about making a nuclear bomb.
So what has bin Laden actually said about using nuclear weapons?
Well, Mr. bin Laden obtained a fatwa, or religious ruling, Anna Maria, from a Saudi cleric authorizing the use of nuclear weapons, quote, even if they annihilate all the infidels. Now, bin Laden obviously isn't giving interviews these days, so we did the next best thing. In Pakistan, I met with Khalid Khawaja. It's about 6:30 in the morning in Islamabad when I accompanied him. He was on his way to morning prayers. He's a late convert in life to Islam, to radical Islam. He's become, though, a sort of unofficial ambassador for Al-Qaeda and its sympathizers in Pakistan. He's fought with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. He worked for Pakistan's very powerful military intelligence services. He's now a successful businessman from Karachi. But he also counts himself, Anna Maria, as a very good friend of Osama bin Laden. He admits to meeting bin Laden more than 100 times, though he wouldn't tell me when he had last met Osama, much less where that encounter took place. But he did say that Muslim fundamentalists around the world have every right to arm themselves with nukes, nuclear weapons, as long as it's done as part of what he called a defensive holy war.
Now the enemy, if they have nukes, if they have missiles, we cannot fight with Kalashnikovs. So it is the duty of all the Muslims, in fact, to make the parallel kind of weapons so that we can fight back. The only weapon we have is this nuke. So if you attack us, so we have no other way, we will give you back this good gift. We don't mind dying, but our enemies, they don't want to die.
Oh, chilling words from Khalid Khawaja, a friend and supporter of Osama bin Laden, you say.
That's
good,
right?
Friend.
Yeah.
But Julian, many people would say nuclear weapons in the hands of anybody, be it a superpower like the U.S., an unstable former empire like Russia, is a dangerous prospect.
That's a good point.
And we've been living under the shadow of the nuclear threat since the 1940s. So is this really more dangerous today?
Well, I think it is because, you know, as scary as the nuclear threat was, remember when you and I were growing up in the 1960s, everybody remembers the Cuban Missile Crisis. But, you know, we lived in a sort of insane insurance policy, if you want. It was actually called MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction. And the whole logic, of course, was that a country would be loath to launch a nuclear strike against a known enemy because they would figure that the retaliation would be just as devastating. But, you know, we're now living, Anna Maria, in what some people are beginning to call the second nuclear age, the age of AQ Khan, where there's no return address, where there is no deterrence. I mean, thanks to Khan, we're seeing sort of the privatization of the atomic bomb, the outsourcing of the bomb.
Well, what would that mean?
Well, for example, it raises the question, would a radical Islamist regime in Iran, which after all has called for Israel to be wiped off the map, would they be willing to take the risks and maybe launch a nuclear attack? Or let's say they develop the bomb, and would their hardliners in government slip, say, a small nuclear weapon or a small quantity of fissile material to make a bomb to sympathetic to terrorists? And then there's North Korea. I mean, it's often been called a black market state. It's involved in drug smuggling and other illegal trafficking. Would they not consider maybe selling their nuclear technology for badly needed cash, I mean, to a rogue state or to an army? Here's how Matthew Bunn of Harvard's Managing the Atom Project put it.
We're no longer talking about, except in the case of some kind of horrifying accident, a nuclear war that would wipe out, you know, hundreds of cities, potentially destroy civilization. That threat is greatly diminished today compared to what it was during the Cold War. But what's probably increased today is the danger that one city would go up in smoke as a result, because it's so much harder to prevent a terrorist from using his weapon than to prevent a state from using his weapon. And the possibility that terrorists could get a nuclear weapon has greatly increased with the rise of terrorist groups that really want nuclear weapons.
That was Matthew Bunn of Harvard University. Now, Anna Maria, I'll leave the last word to Saif Gaddafi. He's the eldest son and the probable successor to Libyan leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. And as you recall, Libya paid $100 million to buy nuclear technology from the Khan network. I sat down with Gaddafi when he was actually visiting Montreal, and I asked him, why did they turn to Khan, of all people, for their nuclear weapons? He smiled, and he looked at me, and he said, for a simple reason, private sector efficiency. And listen to how well he sums up really how drastically AQ Khan has changed the rules of the nuclear game forever.
Private groups, private tourism, private nuclear shops. Everything is private now. Private terrorism, like Al-Qaeda or other groups, they are private. They don't belong to any country, they don't have passports, they don't have nationalities. for nuclear technology to go to private companies. This is globalization. This is the new world.
This is globalization. This is the new world.
Those are his words. I mean, you'd think you'd be reading Thomas Friedman in the New York Times, right? It's the scary flat world, but it's a nuclear flat world.
Yeah, I don't think any of us were thinking of that when we thought of globalization.
No, but those are the consequences of how drastically everything has changed, and we're just not living in the same kind of nuclear world that we were growing up in. The stakes have changed, and everything is much more dangerous and unfortunately scarier.
Well, if we want to know more about this, your documentary is on Thursday, 9 o'clock across the country in every time zone on the main CBC network, 9:30 in Newfoundland and parts of Labrador.
That's right, Anna Maria.
Julian Scher, thank you.
You're welcome.
Julian Scher is a freelance investigative journalist based in Montreal. His documentary, Nuclear Jihad, Can Terrorists Get the Bomb?, is a co-production of the CBC, the New York Times, and the Discovery Times Channel. Well, the news is next, and then where goes culture, so goes the conscience of Quebec. At least that's what sovereignists have always counted on, until two renowned Quebec playwrights said they were disillusioned with the sovereignty movement. We'll have that discussion coming up after the news.